Welcome to another midweek lesson from Grace Christian Assembly. Open your Bible and join us as we dig into the Word. Now, here's our teacher, Jim McLarty.
Today is November 5th, 2014. Yesterday there was an election, a midterm election here in the United States. We have folks who listen around the globe, but it was a pretty big deal here in America. And people listen to these messages sometimes months and years after they go up on the internet. So I just need to point out the date today and the event yesterday, because 2 years ago, when Barack Obama was once again voted into office as the president, there were a lot of folk who couldn't quite understand how that happened, seemed to defy all the odds. And we gathered here, we talked about it on a Wednesday night, right after the election. And there were people kind of wringing their hands and saying, I don't get it. How could this be? How could this happen? And I said, always default to God's sovereignty. And recognize and understand that in order for biblical prophecy to come true, there are certain things that have to happen in the world. And that Barack Obama was much more likely to create a world environment that would put Israel at jeopardy than Mitt Romney would have, he being a much greater supporter of Israel than Obama is and has been. Well, I'm neither a prophet nor the son of a prophet, but over the course of the last 2 years, we've certainly seen that the Middle East has become much more treacherous, a much more dangerous place, and we've seen the rise of the Islamic State and their intention to create a caliphate with the primary goal of the occupation and destruction of Israel. I don't know if you've seen in the last 24 hours a news story that Egyptian jihadists in the area of the Sinai Peninsula, the jihadists in that area have now aligned themselves with the Islamic State, with the intention of creating the Egyptian caliphate. And they stated openly that their goal was the occupation and destruction of Israel. And so I said, the election turned out the way it did because God is sovereign, and even if it doesn't seem to make sense on the surface, even if it doesn't make sense politically, even if it goes against all historic odds, this happened because God is in control. Well, I was happy with the way that the election turned out last night. There was a change in leadership in the Senate, which means that both the Senate and the House of Representatives are both now firmly Republican, which is a good thing. But before we get too excited about that, over and over again I have said, and by now you've heard me say, we humans, anybody on the planet who deals with the politics of this world, we continually hold out this constant hope that the next guy is going to be better. We think the answer, the solution, will be the next guy. Because this guy, the guy right now, this guy, he's making a mess of things. But the next guy. And the more I read history and the more I study history, the more I see that the people of every generation, when they looked at their rulers, when they looked at their leaders, there was always discontent. There have always been rebellions. There has always been a level of discontent with the people who were being ruled by other people. And I'm convinced that that is because human beings are not made for self-rule or self-governance. We're really bad at it whenever it is up to us to create our own rules and regulations and standards. We always end up making those rules that most benefit the people at the top of the food chain or those that benefit the people who have the voting rights or the abilities. I say all that as an introduction to what we're going to look at tonight, because we are continuing in 1 Kings. We're in the middle of chapter 2, and what I want to show you is that the more things change, the more they stay the same. What we're going to look at, starting in verse 28 of 1 Kings chapter 2, is the result of King David telling his son Solomon that there was still some unfinished business, some people who needed to be dealt with, as a result of how they had acted and reacted to King David. But then you're going to see Solomon not only receive tremendous blessing from God, but as soon as he becomes rich and powerful and self-willed, he turns his back on very clear dictates from God. And even though he starts really well, he ends up with the kingdom itself being divided out from under him so that his posterity will no longer rule over the collective 12 tribes of Israel. In other words, the next guy. It's always about, well, the next guy will do better. King David's dying, but the next guy, Solomon, is going to tax the people far beyond what David ever did in order to accomplish his goals and desires, dreams, and building and construction of the things that he wants to do. He's going to collect horses and women and power and money to himself, even though God said, be careful about that. He's going to marry foreign women, and what we're going to read tonight is one of the first marriages that he formed was a marriage with Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, which makes sense again because, as I just mentioned, to this very moment, that Sinai Peninsula that connects Israel with Egypt is a very short distance, especially in these days. It was one thing for 1 million-plus Israelites to walk through that wilderness. It's another thing when you have tanks and jets and cars and mass transit. It's just really, it's a short distance. Well, way back here in King Solomon's day, one of the first things that he did to consolidate his rule there in Israel was to form an alliance with Pharaoh in Egypt, because that part of the world has always been a real dangerous place to live. And the enemies of Israel live all the way around Israel. And the only way that you can explain the continuing existence of Israel is God's sovereign providence. And so God is constant. God keeps his promises. God has continued national Israel on purpose because he has made promises to them that have to come true. He has made promises that reach all the way back to Abraham. He has made covenants like the Davidic covenant that have to come true here on earth. There has to be an establishment of the 12 tribes of Israel. Jesus has to reign from a throne at Jerusalem. And so even as we watch these political machinations of human beings on the planet, we can rest assured that whether the majority is Republican or whether the majority is Democratic or whether there's a guy in the White House that we approve of or whether there's a guy in the White House that we disapprove of, if you look at the long arc of history, you can see God's hand doing exactly what God has always intended to do and working through the willfulness and the decision-making and the rulership of human beings over human beings in order to accomplish his goal and his will. We're going to read right now about things that occurred before Jesus was on the planet. And here we are today, November 5th, 2014, looking at the news and reading about alliances in the same area of the world between Israel, between Egypt. I can understand why Solomon did the things he did. It was a politically expedient thing that he did. But it was an enormous mistake, because as he gathered women to himself from foreign lands and foreign countries, they pulled his heart away exactly as God warned, so that he ended up worshiping foreign gods and losing the kingdom over it. Do you kind of get the big picture there? The more things change, the more they stay the same. Last night I stayed up. I waited until I saw the +7 in the Senate. And I thought to myself, well, good, that's a good outcome. I'm glad for that outcome. But in the end, there's still going to be war. There's still going to be problems. The nation is going to continue to rock and roil and reel and try to figure out what in the world we're doing. And there's still going to be unhappiness. And 2 years from now, there'll be another election. And we'll run to the polls and we'll say, the next guy, he'll be the one that'll fix it. We just always think it's going to be fixed if we can just vote another person into the right position. They will fix things. They won't. History proves that they won't. Human beings are bad at self-governance. Israel was meant to be a theocracy. They were given the rules, they were given the covenant, they were given the law, they were given the standards by which they were to live and how they were to approach and worship God. And the problem that Israel had continually, constantly, we read it all the way through the Old Testament, is that every time God gave them peace and safety, they always ended up rebelling, doing their own thing, going their own way. As soon as God makes Solomon and establishes him as king, and his reputation spreads far and wide, and God gives him peace from all his enemies, he does what he wants to do. The same thing that's happening now. There's peace and safety to some degree, and so the folks in Washington do whatever they want to do. And then there's a threat. And as soon as there's a threat, they go running back to God. Think 9/11. Think everybody running to the Capitol Church, everybody singing God Bless America on the Capitol steps, all the, you know, the panic. Oh, God, help us. And then he does. And then we get a period of peace and safety. And what do? We go back to really questionable self-governance that includes eliminating God from our schools and our society and our conversations and our philosophy of governance. And we just eliminate God. Well, again, this is nothing new. This is how humans have always been. And therefore, I assume it's how humans will always be. There will never be peace on this earth till the Prince of Peace returns. In between now and then, we'll say peace, peace, but there is no peace because you're dealing with sinful, depraved, egocentric human beings. And that's as old as the story of Solomon, who starts well. We're going to see the beginning of his reign tonight. He's going to start so amazingly well. And he's going to end with the dividing up of the kingdom. So we are in 1 Kings chapter 2, verse 28. Last week we looked at David telling Solomon that there were a few people left who still had to be dealt with. I'm just going to assume that you've heard that message and that everybody's up to date. We're not going to review. We're going to jump in right at verse 28, where the news that David has told Solomon that he needs to deal with Joab, that news has reached Joab. For Joab had followed Adonijah, although he had not followed Absalom. Absalom, an older son of David's who had rebelled against David, the one that caused David to run from Jerusalem and cross the Jordan. But he hadn't followed Absalom, but he did follow Adonijah in the attempt to make Adonijah, who was David's fourth son, but he was the eldest living son, so they attempted to make Adonijah king rather than Solomon. So Joab fled to the tent of the Lord, and he took hold of the horns of the altar. If that sounds familiar, it's because that's what Adonijah did. And when Adonijah did it, Solomon was merciful to him. So Joab fled to the tent of the Lord, and he took a hold of the horns of the altar, and it was told King Solomon that Joab had fled to the tent of the Lord, and behold, he is beside the altar. Then Solomon sent Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, saying, go fall upon him. So Benaiah came to the tent of the Lord and said to him, thus says the king, come out. But he said, no, for I will die here. The assumption being they would never kill me here. I'm holding to the altar of the Lord. There's no way they would kill me here. So Benaiah brought the word to the king again, saying, thus spoke Joab. And thus he answered me. He said, I'm not going to come out. I'll die here. So the king said, do as he has spoken. Fall upon him and bury him, that you may remove from me and from my father's house the blood which Joab shed without cause. And the Lord will return his blood on his own head, because he fell upon two men more righteous and better than he, and killed them with the sword, while my father David did not know it. Abner, the son of Ner, commander of the army of Israel, and Amasa, the son of Jether, who was the commander of the army of Judah. So shall their blood return on the head of Joab and on the head of his descendants forever. But to David and his descendants and his house and his throne, may there be peace from the Lord forever. Then Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, went up and fell upon him and put him to death, and he was buried at his own house in the wilderness. And the king appointed Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, over the army in his place. And the king appointed Zadok the priest in the place of Abiathar. And as we saw last week, that was the fulfillment of a prophecy concerning the household of the priests that followed Abiathar. Now the king, verse 36, sent and called for Shimei. Remember Shimei? What was Shimei's crime? Why do we have to deal with Shimei?
He cursed King David.
He cursed King David. But then what did he do? Because remember,
he tried to repent and say he was sorry.
Exactly. So when David was fleeing, he cursed him, right?
Mm-hmm.
Then David gets restored to king of Jerusalem. He comes across the River Jordan again, and Shimei's there going, hey, you know that whole cursing you thing? I didn't mean any of that. I didn't.
David said he would die for this, but not today.
But I won't do it. Yep, yeah. Not today. So he passes it on to Solomon, says, you're a wise man, do what's appropriate with him. So because he both cursed David but also repented, Solomon does a very fair thing to Shimei and puts him under house arrest. Verse 36, now the king sent and called for Shimei and said to him, build for yourself a house in Jerusalem and live there and do not go out from there to any place. For it will happen on the day that you go out and cross over the brook Kidron, that you will know for certain that you shall surely die, and your blood shall be on your own head. It's a very fair deal. Build a house here in Jerusalem, live in it, don't go further than the brook Kidron. If you do, you will surely die, but it's your fault. Verse 38, Shimei then said to the king, your word is good. As my lord the king has said, so your servant shall do. So Shimei lived in Jerusalem many days. But it came about at the end of 3 years. This is, again, just human nature. 3 years. I have restricted myself to this little area for 3 years. By now, I'm sure that Solomon has forgotten about that whole thing. It's been 3 years. Seems like enough. At the end of 3 years, two of the servants of Shimei ran away, which, by the way, is a pretty smart move. If you're a servant that wants to escape and you know that he can't go past the brook Kidron, you go, well, all we got to do is make it past Kidron. We're home free. So two of his servants ran away to Achish, the son of Maacah, the king of Gath. And they told Shimei, saying, behold, your servants are in Gath. Then Shimei arose, saddled his donkey, and went to Gath, to Achish, to look for his servants. And Shimei went and brought his servants from Gath. And it was told to Solomon that Shimei had gone from Jerusalem to Gath and had returned. So the king sent and called for Shimei and said to him, did I not make you swear by the Lord and solemnly warn you, saying, you will know for certain that on the day that you depart and go anywhere that you shall surely die? And you said to me, the word which I have heard is good. Why then have you not kept the oath of the Lord and the command which I have laid on you? The king also said to Shimei, you know all the evil, and you acknowledge it in your heart, which you did to my father David. Therefore the Lord shall return your evil on your own head. But King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever. So the king commanded Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, and he went out, and he fell on him so that he died, and thus the kingdom was established in the hands of Solomon. So that's the culmination of what we read last week. David, as he was dying, giving Solomon final charges, wrapping up his relationship with particular people who had been enemy to him and people who had also been good to him. So Solomon blessed the ones that David wanted blessed. He killed Joab, who deserved to be killed, and he was more than fair with Shimei, and then Shimei, who cursed the king. I think that's one of the reasons that Solomon pointed out, your evil will be on your own head, and you cursed King David, but King Solomon shall be blessed, and the throne of David shall be established before the Lord forever. Because he said that David was a usurper on the throne, and that the throne still belonged to King Saul and his family. Solomon points out, yeah, actually, you're dead and we're blessed. So that's how that works. And that takes us to chapter 3, verse 1. This is what I referred to in my opening remarks, that Solomon formed a marriage alliance with Pharaoh, king of Egypt, and took Pharaoh's daughter and brought her to the city of David until he had finished building his own house and the house of the Lord and the wall around Jerusalem. Now, of course, the person writing 1 Kings, who by all best tradition and history was Jeremiah, he's writing all this from the perspective of knowing the end from the beginning. He's already seen all this and is writing about it once it has already occurred. So he's making reference to things that hadn't yet happened when Solomon formed this alliance. And he's saying that Pharaoh's daughter was brought into the city of David until he had finished building his own house and building the house of the Lord and building the wall around Jerusalem, which are all things that King Solomon is going to do that we're going to read about here in 1 Kings. He just hadn't done them yet. Verse 2 tells us, the people were still sacrificing on the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. Okay, now we have to talk about that because there's a tremendous amount of history and background to that statement that Jeremiah could write here and the original Hebrew audience would read it and understand it. We don't really comprehend it now as 21st century Gentiles, but the history of Israel had been that when they came into the land of Canaan from Egypt, God gave them several instructions about how to deal with the people of Canaan. And it included not worshiping the way that the Canaanites worshiped. They worshiped in their groves and they worshiped on the high hills and high mountaintops, apparently believing that the closer they could get to heaven, the more likely they were that their prayers or petitions would be heard or that their worship would be noticed. And so God was very clear in instructing them not to be like the Canaanites. He also gave them clear instruction not to intermarry. Don't give your sons to their daughters. Don't give your daughters to their sons. Keep your finger right there in 1 Kings chapter 3 and turn, if you would, to Deuteronomy 17. And we'll see a couple of these instructions because they're not in any way vague. Deuteronomy 17, we're going to start at verse 14. Deuteronomy 17, starting at verse 14. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, these are instructions to Israel as they're on their way to the promised land. When you enter the land which the Lord your God gives you, and you possess it and you live in it, and you say, I will set a king over me, like all the nations who are around me. Notice, by the way, that God already knew this is what they were going to want to do. Sure, of course, later they're going to come to Samuel and say, we want a king. We want to be like the other nations. But that's hundreds of years later. And yet God knew, because he knows what people are like. You're going to want to govern yourselves. And you're going to want a leader. You're going to want a king. You're going to want a figurehead. You're going to want somebody because the other nations have that. You're not going to be content with my rules. You're not going to be content with a theocracy. You're not going to be content with following what God says. You're going to want to govern yourselves. When you do that, he says, when you say, I will set a king over me like all the nations that are around me, you shall surely set a king over you whom the Lord your God chooses. One from among your countrymen you shall set as king over yourselves. You may not put a foreigner over yourselves who is not one of your countrymen. Moreover, he shall not multiply horses for himself, nor shall he cause the people to return to Egypt to multiply horses. Since the Lord has said to you, you shall never again return that way. Neither shall he multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. And yet, what happened to Solomon? He increased wives and women to himself. 700 wives, 300 concubines, which, by the way, in our introduction to 1 Kings, I made a passing reference to all Solomon's women, and I said thousands of women, because in my head it was hundreds 700 and 300. It was hundreds that added up to 1,000, and I misspoke and said thousands. And then I got email, naturally, from folks who said, you said thousands. That's not accurate, is it? Because I can't get away with anything because I'm wearing a microphone. So that was a slip of the tongue. No, there weren't thousands. There were hundreds, which seems like enough. 700 wives, 300 concubines, and then we're going to read. Solomon loved many strange women, many foreign women, and they led his heart astray. They led him to follow after their gods, and his willingness to appease them is part of the downfall of Israel. And yet God, back here before they even entered their land, said, he shall not multiply wives for himself, lest his heart turn away. That's exactly what happened. Nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. Now it shall come about, when he sits on the throne of his kingdom, that he shall write for himself a copy of this law on a scroll in the presence of the Levitical priests, and it shall be with him, and he shall read it all the days of his life, that he may learn to fear the Lord his God by carefully observing all the words of this law and these statutes, that his heart may not be lifted up above his countrymen, and that he may not turn aside from the commandment to the right or to the left, in order that he and his sons may continue long in his kingdom in the midst of Israel. So God already laid the warnings out. He already knew what was coming, and he already knew what was going to happen. But he made sure way in advance to say, don't do it. And yet, of course, human beings, once they become self-sufficient, once they get that feeling of, well, this really is up to me, rather than doing what God said and making sure that they read and carefully observed all the rules of the law, had Solomon done that, he would not have made the mistakes that he made. But instead, like all human leaders, Solomon gets caught up in his ability to do whatever he wants, and he gets used to being king. Turn along as we're in Deuteronomy. Turn to Deuteronomy 12 for a moment. Turn back to Deuteronomy 12. I mentioned to you a moment ago that one of the things that the people of Israel were continuing to do was that they were worshiping on the high places. The reason that Jeremiah tells us in 1 Kings that they were worshiping in the high places was apparently because there still was not an established place of worship, which becomes one of the inspirations for Solomon to build the temple that we know to this day as Solomon's Temple, a magnificent temple that Solomon constructs as a place for the Ark of God to stay. But as long as the Ark of God was still in a tent, still mobile, then the people worshiped wherever they wanted to worship. And so God laid out some very particular rules and said that if people were out in their fields or out someplace else and were going to sacrifice, that they had to bring that sacrifice to the door of the tent of meeting. The tent of meeting is that tabernacle, that place where the Ark of God was. They had to bring that sacrifice to the door so that it was first dedicated to Yahweh, then they could take it and sacrifice it. So that there was no confusion about who the sacrifice was for. Because if they were just out on a field or a mountaintop, if they were in a grove and they just sacrificed, then there was no distinction between that and the sacrifices that the Canaanites were making to their gods. So they had to bring their animal to the tent of meeting and dedicate it to God. So one thing that they were supposed to do, according to Deuteronomy 12, start in verse 2, and then we'll skip down. You shall utterly destroy all the places where the nations whom you shall dispossess serve their gods, on the high mountains and on the hills and under every green tree. So God said, don't worship like that. In fact, destroy the places where they built their altars or their places of worship, up on hilltops, on mountaintops, or down in the green areas and in the groves. Skip down to verse 13. Be careful that you do not offer your burnt offerings in every place you see, but in the place which the Lord chooses in one of your tribes. There you shall offer your burnt offerings, and there you shall do all that I command you. So it was God's intention that his ark and his place of worship would be settled. He chose Jerusalem, and so Solomon is ultimately going to build the temple that becomes the established place of worship. This is where you have to come. And three times a year, every man that could travel from all Israel, no matter where they were, had to come to Jerusalem to worship there at that temple. Now, before we're finished with this, turn to Leviticus. If you're in Deuteronomy, it's Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy. So go back two books, go to Leviticus 17. Here in the Levitical rules, there are so many very particular commandments for Israel about worship, about behavior. In chapter 17, we're going to hear about blood atonement. And this is what I referred to just a moment ago, starting at verse 2. Speak to Aaron and to his sons and to all the sons of Israel and say to them, this is what the Lord has commanded, saying, any man from the house of Israel who slaughters an ox or a lamb or a goat in the camp, or who slaughters it outside the camp, and has not brought it to the doorway of the tent of meeting to present it as an offering to the Lord before the tabernacle of the Lord, then blood guiltiness is to be reckoned to that man. He has shed blood, and that man shall be cut off from among his people. The reason is so that the sons of Israel may bring their sacrifice, which they were sacrificing in the open field, and that they may bring them into the Lord. And of course, that capital L-O-R-D there is the proper name of God. That's Yahweh. So that they're sacrificing it to Yahweh at the doorway of the tent of meeting to the priest and sacrifice them as sacrifices of peace offerings to the Lord. So all these instructions about not sacrificing out in the fields. Don't do it on the mountaintops. Don't do it on the hills. Don't do it in the groves. Don't do it the way the Canaanites did. Don't do it the way the previous occupants of this land did it. You need to be separate. You need to be distinct. And your sacrifices must be specifically for Yahweh. Otherwise, it's confusing. Now we're back in 1 Kings 3. Verse 2 of chapter 3 of 1 Kings says, the people were still sacrificing on the high places because there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. So even though Israel did good when they got into the land, and even though they initially destroyed the high places of the Canaanites and their worship, especially during the time of the judges, and we read about it and have read about it through the book of Judges, you saw a greater propensity among the Israelites to go back to those forms of worship. Sometimes because it was just more convenient. Where are we going to worship? Well, there's that tent way over there, but if we go up on a hill, we're probably closer to God than if we go to the tent. And it's a long journey. We'd have to drag the animal and so they just decided they would do it their own way. And part of the reason was that there was no house built for the name of the Lord until those days. So there was no temple. There was no central place for worship. This is part of the inspiration for Solomon to build the temple. Verse 3 then says, now Solomon loved the Lord, walking in the statutes of his father David, except he sacrificed and burned incense on the high places. And we just read all the rules about don't do that. And yet Solomon was doing it, probably because it was common among the people. That's what you see in verse 4. The king went to Gibeon to sacrifice there, for that was the great high place. That's where all the people go. That's where the king goes. Solomon offered 1,000 burnt offerings on that altar. That was quite a day for offerings. 1,000 burnt offerings. In Gibeon, the Lord appeared to Solomon in a dream at night, and God said, ask what you wish me to give you. Solomon said, You have shown great loving kindness to thy servant David, my father, according as he walked before thee in truth and righteousness and uprightness of heart toward thee. And thou hast reserved for him this great loving kindness, that thou hast given him a son to sit on his throne as it is this day. And now, O Lord my God, thou hast made thy servant king in the place of my father David, and yet I am but a little child. I do not know how to go out or come in. Now, chronologically speaking, he wasn't a child at this point. He's speaking, obviously, metaphorically and saying, when it comes to how to be a king, and the chief job of the king was judgment, how to be a good judge, how to determine the rules, how to decide between one and the other, how to lead the nation. And so he's saying, I'm new to all this. I'm young at all this. I don't know how to do this. And that's why in verse 8 he says, thy servant is in the midst of thy people, which thou hast chosen, a great people who cannot be numbered or counted for multitude. So give thy servant an understanding heart to judge thy people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of thine? In other words, this is a tremendous number of people, and I'm their only king, and this is what I'm going to end up doing night and day. I'm going to be judging the people, determining what's right, what's wrong, what's fair, what's not, what rules were broken, what laws, what statutes, what the punishment has to be. This was one of the chief jobs of a king, especially during peacetime, because he's not leading them in war. So he's making alliances, he's making political decisions. It's all about judgment, 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 making good determinations. So he asked, give me an understanding heart to judge your people, to discern between good and evil. For who is able to judge this great people of thine? God said to him, look at this, verse 10. And it was pleasing in the sight of the Lord that Solomon had asked this thing. And God said to him, because you have asked this thing and have not asked for yourself long life, nor have asked riches for yourself, nor have you asked for the life of your enemies, but you have asked for yourself discernment to understand justice. Behold, I have done according to your words. Behold, I have given you a wise and discerning heart, so that there has been no one like you before you, nor shall one like you arise after you. And I have also given you what you have not asked, both riches and honor, so that there will not be any among the kings like you all your days. And if you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments, as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days. So let's go through that bit by bit. God says, ask what you want to ask. Ask me for something. Think of all the things Solomon could have asked for at that moment. But he asked for judgment. He asked for wisdom so that he would know how to properly judge the people that belong to God. This is a great start to Solomon's kingship. What a great start. And God responds by saying, because you didn't ask for me to kill all your enemies, or because you didn't ask for long life for yourself, because you didn't ask that you would get riches and honor, I'm going to give you what you asked for, and I'm going to add all this other stuff to you. I'm going to make you the kind of king that other kings are going to be envious of. There's never been a king like you, and there's not going to be another one after you. Which is why, to this day, who doesn't know the name Solomon? When we talk about wisdom, they say, oh, the Solomon of wisdom. When they talk about great kings, they talk about Solomon. We actually have an adjective form of his name, Solomonic. When we talk about somebody being very wise, right? Oh, Solomonic wisdom. We know his name, and we can't think of another king that has risen to the sort of fame and universal recognition that Solomon rose to, and we continue to know his name to this very day because God is faithful and kept his word. But he also put a caveat on it. I'll give you what you asked. I'll give you riches and honor as well so that there will not be any among the kings like you for all your days. And if, there's the caveat, you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and my commandments as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days. Not just prolong your days, as in long life, but I will establish the throne to your descendants. I will establish the house of David through Solomon. He starts so well. And as I've already referred, and as we'll see in the weeks to come, in his failure, God divides the kingdom. And God says to him, because of David and because of the promises I made to David, I'm not going to do it in your lifetime, but your son, your heritage, your household will not reign over the 12 tribes the way you and David did. And the northern tribes are not only divided up and given to Jeroboam, but the continuation of southern kings continues to go from like bad to worse to bad to worse. They get the occasional good king, but it's just all downhill from there. Meanwhile, among the northern kings, because right away their kings want to make a separation between the northern and the southern tribes, and because they recognize that the house of Solomon, the house of God, where the worship is in Jerusalem, they immediately reestablish all that Canaanitish foreign worship back to the hilltops, back to the groves, chasing after all the foreign gods, and they apostatize as a nation immediately, and in the entire history of the northern tribes, not one good king. The southern tribes get the occasional good king, occasionally, and then they lapse back into their worst kings. In the north, nothing. Because Solomon didn't do what God said to do. Now, we read some of what God said don't do. That's why I read it out. It's not vague. This is what you do. This is how you act. And when you get a king, this is how the king should be. Don't multiply wives. Well, he does. Don't multiply horses. Well, he does. Don't multiply gold and riches and stuff to yourself. Well, he does. And in fact, he taxes the people to the point where they're rife for rebellion. By the time the northern tribes separate from the southern tribes, the northern tribes are all set, ready to go, ready to separate, because they are already rebellious against the house of Solomon because of the burden of taxation that he placed on them in order to accomplish the building plan that he had in Jerusalem. Any of this sounding familiar? Mm-hmm. Have we learned anything from history?
Evidently not.
Evidently not. Yes, sir.
I have a question concerning the wealth that God has given Solomon. Mm-hmm. When God said to him that I will give him riches and honor, mm-hmm. why would Solomon feel the need to tax the people so heavily? And in fact, why don't we turn this around to, why would God be angry at Solomon if he is getting riches when
because,
God said he would?
Right. Because the chief thing that happened to Solomon isn't the riches. It's that his heart is turned away from God.
I know this.
Between the power, between the wealth, between the women, between the authority and the reputation, all of that causes Solomon to become self-willed and do what he wants to do rather than stay with and follow the commandments and the regulations of God. And that's the real crime.
I see.
I think we just talked about this on Sunday. Money in and of itself isn't the real problem. It's not the heart of the issue. It's what do you think of the money? What does the money do to you? And yeah, God made Solomon very wealthy. And yet, as he was determined to build greater palaces and build the wall of Jerusalem and build the great temple, he did it on the backs of the people. And remember one of the things that we read, when you get a king, he's not to put himself above the people. And yet he did exactly that. So where he should have been following the rules, the regulations, the commands, the dictates of God, so that Israel was indeed being ultimately ruled by, regulated by God and his law, instead Solomon started doing things his way. And that is always the problem. I can relate it again to our most recent political environment. America was established. Our laws were based in biblical rules, regulations, standards, the Ten Commandments, all that. Now, you've got people, you read about it in the news all the time, who object to the Ten Commandments being posted anywhere, in any courthouse. They object to a Bible in schools. They object to... in the United States, I know it's a short question and a long answer. I'm just trying to get perspective. In the United States, the first schools were established by churches, which is where the original notion even of Sunday school comes from. But the first schools were established by churches for the purpose of teaching children how to read so that, expressly and specifically, they could read their Bible. And the chief textbook was the Bible. And so every day in school included prayer and the recognition of who God was and His Word, and this was the function of education. The first universities planted on American soil, I've said this many, many times, were not only planted by Calvinists, but were planted by Christians. Higher education always included an education in theology. And not just any theology. You weren't considered fully educated in colonial America if you weren't at least conversant in Calvinistic theology and soteriology. If you couldn't speak intelligently about Christianity, it didn't matter what else you knew. You still weren't fully educated. 200 years later, where are we at? God blesses people, generations of people, and they bask in His marvelous blessings, and they worship Him at the time, and they recognize Him as their God and recognize the blessings. And then once they become used to the blessing, once it becomes part of their everyday life, they forget that it's still God who's providing it. They become self-willed. They start self-governing. And they always govern in favor of their flesh and away from God. That is the history of human beings. And we're seeing it in America right here, right now, today. Mm-hmm. We shouldn't be surprised by it because that's the history of the Bible. And even as the cynics and the atheists and the anti-God movements in America are decrying the Bible and working so hard to get it out of every marketplace of ideas and get it out of our educational system and, you know, anything that gets any kind of government money, you can't say anything at all about God or Christ or anything else. Separation of church and state, an idea that they have completely misappropriated for themselves. They don't understand what that phrase was meant to say. That phrase, first off, doesn't appear anywhere. I'm just going off now. That phrase does not exist anywhere in the original Constitution or any of its amendments. It is a phrase that comes out of a letter from Thomas Jefferson, and what he was speaking about at the time was making sure that the state did not encroach on the church. That was why he drew a wall of separation between the church and state. That has now been turned on its head,
right,
and say that the state has to be protected from the encroachment of the church. That's completely opposite what the phrase originally meant. I can keep going, but I won't. But all I'm trying to do is pile on the evidence that human beings, when they self-govern, never do well, because they will always govern in favor of their own flesh, their own desires, their own ego, their own wantonness, and they will always move from God, not toward God. Proof yet again of their depravity and their sinfulness. Oh, and I began to say, and whenever the atheist groups or whenever any of these folk try to eliminate the Bible and say it's unnecessary in our society, we don't want it, we don't need it, all they're doing is proving the veracity and the truthfulness of the Bible, which says that's exactly what people are like. Mm. The Bible says human beings are God-haters by nature. So the God-haters come around and say, well, we don't want the Bible. Right. And the Bible said you wouldn't. So you're even giving evidence that the Bible is true in describing the nature of human beings. Then you take that mess of depraved human beings and say, why don't some of you govern each other? How can that ever go well? It never does. Right?
Sorry. Didn't mean to get you...
No, that's fine. You clicked that switch in my head and off we went. All right, we're nearly done here. Verse 14, if you walk in my ways, keeping my statutes and commandments, as your father David walked, then I will prolong your days. Then Solomon awoke, and behold, it was a dream. And he came to Jerusalem, and he stood before the ark of the covenant of the Lord, and he offered burnt offerings and made peace offerings and made a feast for all his servants. There's a really interesting transition there that I don't want you to miss. It started with Solomon going to Gibeon and sacrificing up on the high hills and the high mountains, and sacrificing, what did we say, 1,000 animals? God comes to him in a dream. He has an encounter with God. What's the next thing he does? He goes directly to Jerusalem, to the Ark of the Covenant. Go where Yahweh is. Remember the rule we read? Every sacrifice you make, you have to bring it to the door of the tent of meeting. You have to make sure that people know this is a sacrifice to Yahweh before you sacrifice it. Where does he run? Right back to the Ark of the Covenant. Back to God. Back to Yahweh. So there's a transition made there in his mind, in his heart. He recognizes that he's got to go back to God and offers burnt offerings there and made peace offerings and then made a feast for all his servants. Now, the balance of this chapter, which we'll read out tonight, it'll only take us about 10 minutes, is the first example and a very well-known example of Solomon's wisdom. I don't want to upset either of the kids that are in the room, but we're going to talk about dead babies, so be aware. Then two women who were harlots came to the king and stood before him. And one woman said, "Oh, my lord, this woman and I live in the same house. I gave birth to a child while she was in the house. And it happened on the third day after I gave birth that this woman also gave birth to a child, and we were together. There was no stranger with us in the house, only the two of us in the house. And this woman's son died in the night because she laid on it. So she arose in the middle of the night. She took my son from beside me while your maidservant slept, and laid him in her bosom, and laid her dead son in my bosom. And when I rose in the morning to nurse my son, behold, he was dead. But when I looked at him carefully in the morning, behold, this was not my son whom I had born." And the other woman said, "No, for the living one is my son, and the dead one is your son." But the first woman said, "No, for the dead one is your son, and the living one is my son." And thus they spoke before the king. So you've got two women, both harlots. But remember I said to you, one of the chief jobs of the king was to decide and to judge between people. Even two harlots managed to get their case in front of the king. And the argument is, we're both living in a house. We had babies 3 days apart. This one laid on her child till it suffocated. He's dead. She got up in the middle of the night. Switch babies. And when I woke up and looked at my baby, it was dead. Then I realized, this isn't my baby. As any mother would. She would know whether it was her baby or not. This isn't my baby. So this woman obviously has swapped babies. And the other one argues and says, no, it's just the opposite. It's just the other way around. The dead baby is hers and the living one is mine. And back and forth they argue because they both want the living child. So here's how Solomon decided it. Verse 23. Then the king said, "The one says, 'This is my son who is living, and your son is the dead one.' And the other says, 'No, for your son is the dead one, and my son is the living one.' And the king said, 'Get me a sword.' So they brought a sword before the king. And the king said, 'Divide the living child in two, and give half to one and half to the other.'" That's how he decided to solve it. Okay, there's one living child and there's two of you. Cut them in half. And you can each have a half a baby. Now this sounds like crazy judgment. What are you saying? There's already one dead child. What are you saying? Get a sword and divide the other one. Hey, you both want him? You can both have a half a child. How's that work for you? But this is the incredible wisdom of Solomon, and this is the first example. Remember, he asked God, "Give me the wisdom to judge well among your people." The king said, "Divide the living child in two and give one half to one and half to the other." And the woman whose child was the living one spoke to the king, for she was deeply stirred over her son. And she said, "Oh, my lord, give her the living child and by no means kill it." But the other one said, "He won't be either yours or mine. Go ahead and divide him." Two different reactions from two different women. Now, of course, the writer, Jeremiah, narrates it for us in such a way that we know the thought process of the two women. And the one whose child it really was had a heart for her own living child and said, "No, I'd rather that he live with this woman than die." And the one whose child it was not didn't have a heart for him and had already lost her own child and said, "Fine, divide up the child." And that allowed Solomon to know who the real mother was. Then the king answered and said, "Give the first woman the living child and by no means kill him. She is his mother." He never intended to do that to the child. He wanted to see what the women would say. And based on their reaction, he knew who the mother was. And he said, "Now return the child to his rightful mother." Very clever, very wise. When all Israel heard of the judgment which the king had handed down, they feared the king. That's reverenced the king, for they saw that the wisdom of God was in him to administer justice. So, as I said at the beginning, I say again, Solomon started really well. Solomon starts off with God's blessing, a peaceful kingdom that's established all 12 tribes in unity, and he starts out with a reputation for being a good and a wise king and a good judge, and the promise of God that he's going to make him unlike any other king. He starts so well. And yet, as we go through the chapters ahead in the weeks to come, there'll be a couple chapters that are going to be kind of tough to get through because some of them are just full of the names of his different captains and commanders. Some of them are all of the supplies that were brought in order to build the temple. So there's a lot of lists and a lot of facts, figures, and details, and we'll just have to survey our way through those. But then we're also going to see this turning point where we read that Solomon loved many foreign women and that they took his heart away and he followed after their gods. And we see the downfall of this great king. And the warning in that, I think, is the fact that if Solomon, in all his wisdom, if he could fall prey to false worship, if he could fall prey to the enticements of this world and the deceitfulness of riches, if he could fall prey to his own flesh and his own ego, then that is fair warning that we all need to be wise in the things that we allow into our life. Isn't that kind of what we talked about on Sunday morning? Be careful what you let into your eyes. Be careful what you think about. Be careful what you do. In Solomon's case, he was supposed to have the law of God in front of him. We read it. God said there was the law of God was supposed to be there, and he was supposed to meditate on it daily. David writes about it in the Psalms, how he delights in the law of God and how he meditated on it over and over. Solomon seems not to have done that. Solomon went his own way. Now, of course, during that period of his rulership, Solomon, by God's grace, has given us a tremendous compendium of good thinking and wisdom, but even he fell prey to his flesh. And that should be a warning to us all, regardless of who won the Senate. There, I brought it full circle. Did you see that? Brought it all the way back around, right back to where we started, and did it in about an hour. So there you go.
Thank you for joining us for this week's lesson. If you would like more information about Grace Christian Assembly or the teaching of God's sovereign grace, please visit us on the World Wide Web at salvationbygrace.org.